European victory meant England would now honor those neutral rights de facto, if not de jure. Other territorial disputes over fishing waters and the American-Canadian boundary near Maine were referred to commissions, where they languished for decades. The Treaty of Ghent thus signified that, officially at least, the war had changed nothing, and the terms of peace were such that conditions were now the same as they had been prior to the war, status quo ante bellum. Madison must have been apprehensive about presenting such a peace without victory for the approval of the U.S. Senate. Fortunately for Madison's party, news of the Ghent Treaty arrived in Washington, D.C. at exactly the same time as news of an untimely, yet nevertheless glorious American military victory. On January 8, 1815, Andrew Jackson's odd coalition of American troops had pounded General Pakenham's British regulars and won the famed Battle of New Orleans. Jackson's victory was mythologized once again with a David and Goliath twist in which outnumbered American sharpshooters defeated the disciplined redcoats. The fact was that Jackson's men were seasoned combat veterans of the Creek Indian Theater of the War of 1812 and the Battle of Horseshoe Bend, 1814. Now at New Orleans, they were joined by a polyglot collection of local French, Creole and Cajun, Spanish, and free black troops, with a few Caribbean pirates under Jean Lafitte thrown in for good measure. The nub of the army remained hardcore Jackson veterans, except for key Creole militia artillery units. Together they manned the breastworks of Chalmette, near New Orleans, and awaited Pakenham's force of 8,000. Jackson had all the advantages. His men were dug in on both sides of the Mississippi, protected by a thick breastwork, and the British had to either endure murderous enfilade fire or simultaneously attack both positions, always a tricky proposition. Most important, Jackson had plenty of artillery and had chosen the perfect ground, a dense swamp forest on his left, the canal on his right, and a huge expanse of open field over which the redcoats would have to cross. Merely getting to the battlefield had proven a disaster for the British because their troops had had to row through the lakes and marshes, and each British guardsman carried an 8-pound cannonball in his knapsack. When several of those boats tipped over, the soldiers sank like the lead they carried. Under the cover of a dawn fog, the British drew up for a bold frontal assault on the American position. Then suddenly the same fog that had concealed their formation on the field lifted, revealing them to Jackson's guns. Sharpshooting militiamen using Kentucky long rifles, accurate at hundreds of yards, took their toll, but the British ranks were broken by the Louisiana artillerymen. Pakenham himself was shot several times and died on the field, alongside more than 2,000 British casualties, dramatically contrasting the 21 Americans killed. Adding insult to injury, or death in this case, the deceased Pakenham suffered the indignity of having his body stuffed into a cask of rum for preservation en route to England. Jackson emerged a hero, and soon Americans were dancing to a popular song about his army that bragged, "Every man was half a horse and half an alligator." Madison pardoned pirate Jean Lafitte as thanks for his contributions, and the Federalists looked like fools for their untimely opposition. It was a bloody affair, but not, as many historians suggest, a useless one. A needless encounter in a needless war, the refrain goes. One conclusion was inescapable after the war. The Americans were rapidly becoming the equals of any power in Europe. A nation whose spirit was everywhere. Notwithstanding 1,000 blunders, John Adams wrote candidly and jubilantly to Jefferson in 1814, President James Madison had acquired more glory and established more union than all his three predecessors, Washington, Adams, Jefferson, put together. Perhaps Adams meant to rub salt in Jefferson's wounds, but by any measure, the changes for America over a period of just a few months were, indeed, stunning. America's execution of the war had extracted a begrudging respect from Britain. In the future, Britain and all of Europe would resort to negotiation, not war, in disputing America. They had learned to fear and respect this new member in the family of nations. America's subsequent reference to the War of 1812 as the Second War for Independence was well-founded. On the home front, the war produced important military and political changes, especially in the Ohio Valley, where the hostile Indian tribes were utterly defeated. But so too were the Creek of Alabama, Mississippi, and Florida. The War of 1812 set the stage for the First Seminole War, 1818, Black Hawk's War, 1832, and the federal Indian removal that would, in a mere 25 years, exile most remaining Cherokee, Choctaw, Creek, Seminole, and Chickasaw Indians to the Indian Territory in Oklahoma. In a sense, the War of 1812 was not so much a victory over England as over the Indians, smashing the power forever of all tribes east of the Mississippi. Politically, the Federalist Party died, its last stalwarts slinking into the Republican opposition and forming a viable new National Republican Caucus. They learned to practice the Democratic politics the Jeffersonians had perfected, mingle with the crowds and buy a round of liquor, host campaign barbecues and fish fries, shake hands, and perhaps even kiss a few babies. In this way, these nationalists were able to continue to expound Hamilton's program of tariffs, banks, and subsidized industrialism, but do so in a new democratic rhetoric that appealed to the common man, soon seen in the programs championed by Henry Clay. Within the Republican Party, National Republicans continued to battle old Republicans over the legacy of the American Revolution. Within a generation, these National Republicans would form the Whig Party. Jefferson's ideologically pure, old, Democratic Republicans died, yielding to a newer, more aggressive political machine under the Jacksonians. Tragically, the increasingly Southern bent of the old Republicans meant that the radical individualism, decentralism, and states' rights tenets of Jeffersonianism would, under the Southern Democrats, be perverted. Jefferson's libertarian ideals, the ideals of the American Revolution, would, incongruously, be used to defend the enslavement of 3 million human beings. Chapter 6. The First Era of Big Government, 1815-36. Watershed Years. Northeastern Americans awoke one morning in 1816 to find a 20-inch snowfall throughout their region, with some flakes reported as being 2 inches across. This might not seem unusual, except that it was June 6th, and the snow continued throughout July and August in what one diarist called the most gloomy and extraordinary weather ever seen. Little did he know that on the other side of the world, the eruption of Mount Tambora in Java had shot clouds of dust into the stratosphere, creating a temporary global cooling that left Ohio farmers to deal with a rash of ruined crops and a disorienting haze to match the economic malaise gripping the nation. Within just 20 years, the United States would suffer another depression blamed on the financial repercussions of Andrew Jackson's War on the Bank of the United States. Journalists of the day and generations of historians since, until well into the 1960s, agreed that government policies had brought on the recession. In fact, the root cause was outside our borders in the case of the Panic of 1837, in Mexico, where the silver mines dried up. In each case, Americans experienced the effects at home of relatively normal and natural events, a volcano and the depletion of a silver vein that had their origins abroad. And in each case, despite the desire of many citizens to quietly live isolated within the nation's 1815 boundaries, The explosion of Mount Tambora and the silver depletion of Mexican mines revealed how integrated the young United States already was with the natural, financial, and political life of the entire world. Having stood toe-to-toe with Britain for the second time in 40 years in the War of 1812, the young republic had indeed attained a new position in world affairs and in international influence. Although hardly a dominant national state capable of forcing the Europeans to rethink most of their balance of power principles, the United States nevertheless had proven its mettle through a victory over the Barbary pirates, careful diplomacy with Napoleon's France, and a faltering but eventually successful war with England. At home, the nation entered its most important era since the early constitutional period. James Madison, successor to Jefferson, and John Adams's own son, John Quincy Adams, both referred to themselves as Republicans. Consensus blended former foes into a single-party rule that yielded the Era of Good Feelings, a term first used by a Boston newspaper in 1817. In a natural two-party system, such unanimity is not healthy, and, at any rate, it began to mask a more substantial transformation occurring beneath the tranquil surface of uniparty politics. Change occurred at almost every level. States individually started to reduce or waive entirely property requirements to vote. New utopian movements and religious revivals sprang up to fill Americans with a new spiritual purpose. The issue of slavery, which so many of the founders hoped would simply go away, thrust itself into daily life with an even greater malignant presence. How the generation who came to power during the Age of Jackson, as it is called, dealt with these issues has forever affected all Americans. To this day, we still maintain, and often struggle with reforming, the two-party political system Jacksonians established to defuse the explosive slavery issue. We also continue to have daily events explained by and shaped by a free journalistic elite that was born during the Jacksonian era. And modern Americans frequently revert to class demagoguery that characterized debates about the economic issues of the day, especially the Second Bank of the United States. Timeline. 1814, Treaty of Ghent ends War of 1812. 1816, James Monroe elected president. 1818, Andrew Jackson seizes Florida from Spain and the Seminoles. 1819, Adams-Onis Treaty. 1819, McCulloch versus Maryland. 1819-22, Missouri Compromises. 1823, Monroe Doctrine, American Fur Company establishes Fort Union on Missouri River. 1824, John Quincy Adams defeats Jackson in controversial election. 1828, Tariff of Abominations, Jackson defeats Adams. 1831, William Lloyd Garrison publishes first issue of The Liberator. 1832, Nullification Crisis, Worcester versus Georgia. 1836, Texas Independence, Martin Van Buren elected president. 1837, Panic of 1837. The Second Bank of the United States. Contrary to the notion that war is good for business, the War of 1812 disrupted markets, threw the infant banking system into confusion, and interrupted a steady pattern of growth. Trade was restored to Britain and Canada quickly, and after Waterloo, markets to France opened as well. But the debt incurred by the war made hash of the Jeffersonians' strict fiscal policies, sending the national debt from $45 million in 1812 to $127 million in 1815, despite the imposition of new taxes. Since the nation borrowed most of that money through short-term notes from private banks, and since Congress had refused to recharter the Bank of the United States in 1811, both the number of banks and the amount of money they issued soared. Banking practices of the day differed so sharply from modern commercial banking that it bears briefly examining the basics of finance as practiced in the early 1800s. First, at the time, any state-chartered bank could print money, notes, as long as the notes were backed by gold or silver specie in its vault. During the War of 1812, most state-chartered banks outside New England suspended specie payments, even though they continued to operate and print notes without the discipline of gold backing. Second, state legislatures used the chartering process to exert some measure of discipline on the banks. A number of private banks operated outside the charter process, but they did not print notes. Nevertheless, it was the market through the specie reserve system that really regulated the bank's inclination to print excessive numbers of notes. Most banks in normal times tended to keep a reserve of 5 to 20% specie in their vaults to deal with runs or panics. Pressures of war, however, had allowed the banks to suspend and then continue to print notes, generating inflation. Rather than wait for the private banking system to sort things out, and with some support from the financiers themselves, who wanted a solution sooner rather than later, in 1816 Congress chartered a new national bank, the Second Bank of the United States, BUS. Like its predecessor, the Second BUS had several advantages over state-chartered private banks, most notably its authority to open branches in any state it chose. Its $35 million capitalization dwarfed that of any state-chartered private bank, but more important, its designation as the depository of federal funds gave the BUS a deposit base several times greater than its next largest competitor. Special privilege became an oft-repeated criticism of the BUS, especially the uncertain nature of who exactly enjoyed that special privilege. More than a few Americans of a conspiratorial bent suspected that foreigners, especially British investors, secretly controlled the bank. Combined with the bank's substantial influence and pervasive presence throughout the nation, special privilege made the BUS an easy target for politicians, who immediately took aim at the institution when any serious economic dislocation occurred. It should be restated that the BUS carried strong overtones of Hamilton's Federalists, whose program, while dormant, was quietly transforming into the American system of the National Republicans, soon to be Whigs. Immediately after the War of 1812, the Federalist political identification with the BUS faded somewhat, even though important backers such as Stephen Girard and Albert Gallatin remained prominent. More important were the economic fluctuations the bank dealt with as it attempted to rein in the inflation that had followed the Treaty of Ghent. Calling in many of its outstanding loans, the BUS contracted the money supply, producing lower prices. That was both good news and bad news. Obviously, consumers with money thrived as prices for finished goods fell. At the level of the common man in a still largely agrarian republic, falling farm prices and a widespread difficulty in obtaining new loans for agriculture or business caused no small degree of economic dislocation. Cotton prices crashed in January 1819, falling by half when British buyers started to import Indian cotton. Land prices followed. Although the BUS had only limited influence in all this, its size made it a predictable target. BUS President William Jones shouldered the blame for this panic, as depressions were called at the time. Bank directors replaced Jones with South Carolinian Langdon Chivas. To the director's horror, Chivas continued Jones's policy of credit contraction, which left the bank with substantial lands taken as mortgage foreclosures and added to complaints that the BUS existed for a privileged elite. By that time, the Depression had spread to the industrial sector. Philadelphia mills that employed more than 2,300 in 1816 retained only 149 in 1819, and John Quincy Adams warned that the collapse posed a crisis which will shake the Union to its center. Governor Ethan Brown of Ohio wrote, "The citizens of every class are uniformly delinquent in discharging even the most trifling of debts." President Monroe reacted sensibly by urging the repeal of internal taxes. Chivas, for his part, was not intimidated, however, by the necessity to purge the once inflated bank paper or dump worthless land. Despite recriminations from Congress and complaints from monetary experts like William Gouge, who moaned that the bank was saved but the people were ruined, Chivas kept the BUS open while continuing a tight money policy. The economy revived before long, though its recovery was linked more to the influx of Mexican silver than to any central bank policies undertaken by Chivas. The episode convinced many Americans, however, that the bank wielded inordinate powers, for good or evil. Marshall and the Markets. In the meantime, the BUS was at the center of one of the more important cases in American law, McCulloch versus Maryland. The state of Maryland sought to levy a tax on the Baltimore branch of the BUS, which the cashier of the bank, James McCulloch, refused to pay, forcing a test of federal power. Two constitutional issues came before the court. First, did states have the power to tax federal institutions within their borders? Second, since the BUS was not explicitly mentioned in the Constitution, was it even legal in the first place? Chief Justice Marshall, famous for his perception that the power to tax involves the power to destroy, led a unanimous court in upholding the 1790s decision that no state could tax federal property. Marshall's ruling was a reasonable and critical position on the primacy of the national government in a federal system. When it came to the legality of the BUS, Marshall turned to Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, which Hamilton had used to justify the first BUS. Congress has the power to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers. Referred to as the Necessary and Proper Clause, Section 8 essentially allowed Congress to do anything that either the United States Supreme Court by a ruling or the people through an amendment to the Constitution itself did not prohibit. In future generations, that would include such questionable initiatives as Social Security, welfare, funding for the arts and humanities, establishing scientific and medical agencies, and creating the departments of energy, education, and commerce. Still, the essential power always rested with the people, regardless of court decisions, because, as the old maxim goes, the people generally get what they want. If the public ever grew fearful or dissatisfied with any governmental agency, the voters could abolish it quickly through either the ballot box or an amendment process. Marshall well knew that every undertaking of the federal government could not be subject to specific constitutional scrutiny, a point reflected by his ruling in favor of the constitutionality of the BUS. Marshall then turned the states' rights arguments against the states themselves in 1821 with Cohen's versus Virginia, wherein the Supreme Court, citing New Hampshire court's proclivity for judicial review of that state's legislature, affirmed that the United States Supreme Court had judicial review authority over the states' courts as well. McCulloch came the same year as the Dartmouth College decision and coincided with another ruling, Sturgis versus Crowninshield, in which Marshall's court upheld the Constitution's provisions on contracts. That Marshall sided with greater centralized federal power is undeniable, but the conditions were such that in these cases, the struggles were largely between private property and contract rights against government authority of any type. In that sense, Marshall stood with private property. In the Dartmouth College case, the state of New Hampshire had attempted to void the charter of Dartmouth College, which had been founded in 1769 by King George III, to make it a public school. Dartmouth employed the renowned orator and statesman Daniel Webster, and Dartmouth alumnus, to argue its case. Marshall's court ruled unanimously that a contract was a contract, regardless of the circumstances of its origination, save duress, and that New Hampshire was legally bound to observe the charter. The Marshall Court's unanimous decision reinforced the 1810 Fletcher v. Peck ruling, in which the court upheld a state legislature's grant of land as a valid contract, even though a subsequent legislature repealed it. Taken with Peck, the Dartmouth decision established without question the primacy of law and contractual arrangements in a free society. Later supplemented by other decisions that maintained a competitive marketplace, such as Gibbons v. Ogden, 1824, and Charles River Bridge v. Warren Bridge, 1837, under Chief Justice Roger Taney, the Supreme Court continually reaffirmed the importance of property rights in a free society. At first glance, Gibbons v. Ogden related only to federal authority over waterways, but in fact, the court in broad terms established that, barring federal prohibitions, interstate trade was open to all competitors. And in the Charles River Bridge case, the court again upheld the principle of competition, stating that the charter did not imply a monopoly, and that a monopoly could exist only if expressly granted by a state. Thus, as the Marshall era came to a close, the Supreme Court had chipped away at some state powers, but Marshall himself enthusiastically admitted that when it came to the federal government, the powers of the government are limited and its limits are not to be transcended. To those who complained about Marshall's aggrandizement of power at the federal level, the Chief Justice in clear Hamiltonian tones stated guidelines: "Let the end be legitimate. Let it be within the scope of the Constitution, and all means which are appropriate, which are plainly adapted to that end, which are not prohibited, but consist with the letter and spirit of the Constitution, are constitutional." It is equally true, though, that Marshall, later aided and abetted by Taney, enhanced the broader and more important mechanisms of the free market over state government, and in the process solidified the critical premise of sanctity of contract. Without John Marshall, whom John Taylor, one of his severest critics, denigrated as part of a subtle core of miners and sappers working to undermine the foundations of our confederated fabric, that fabric would have unraveled in a frenzy of property rights abridgments at the state level. The Virginia dynasty continued. In December 1816, James Monroe of Virginia perpetuated the dominance of Virginians in the office of the presidency, defeating the Federalist Rufus King of New York in a landslide, 183-34 votes in the Electoral College. Virginia's continued grip on the nation's highest office had in fact been ensured earlier when Monroe bested William H. Crawford of Georgia in a narrow vote for the Republican nomination. That meant that of America's first five presidents, all had come from Virginia except Adams, although Monroe would be the last elected president from Virginia. Neither William Henry Harrison nor Woodrow Wilson, both born in the state, were associated with or considered Virginians when they ran for office, and John Tyler ascended to the presidency only upon Harrison's death. Following the Burr fiasco, the 12th Amendment to the Constitution eliminated the possibility that a president and vice president could come from different parties, meaning that the Republicans' choice for vice president, Daniel D. Tompkins of New York, helped initiate a common practice of adding sectional balance to a ticket. Monroe, born 1758, had attended William and Mary College before leaving to serve in the Continental Army under Washington. He saw action at many of the Revolution's famous battles, including White Plains, Trenton, where he was wounded, Germantown, Brandywine, and Monmouth, attaining the rank of colonel. A deliberate, even slow thinker, Monroe gathered ideas and advice from associates and subordinates before proceeding, a trait that kept him from a field command in the Revolution. He therefore resigned his commission to study the law under Jefferson and then won a seat in the Virginia House of Delegates, 1782, the Continental Congress, 1783-86, and the Virginia State Convention, 1788. Working under Jefferson led to a friendship between the two and drew Monroe somewhat naturally into the sage's anti-federal views. Consequently, he was not a delegate at the Constitutional Convention, yet when Virginia needed a U.S. senator in 1790, Monroe won the seat. Senator Monroe proved an able lieutenant to Secretary of State Jefferson and clashed repeatedly with Alexander Hamilton and President Washington himself. A natural successor to Jefferson as the Minister to France, 1794, Monroe failed to assuage French concerns over the pro-British treaty negotiated by John Jay, and thus was recalled after 2 years, although he returned as an envoy extraordinaire in 1802. During the gap in his years abroad, Monroe became governor of Virginia. He joined Robert Livingston during the negotiations over Louisiana, then made ministerial journeys to England and Spain. None of these overtures accomplished their intended purposes, indeed failing miserably to placate the French over Jay's treaty, settle the boundary dispute with Spain, or obtain a commercial treaty with England. In the case of the British negotiations conducted with Special Envoy William Pinckney, Monroe was convinced he had obtained reasonable terms easing trade restrictions. Jefferson, however, dismissed the effort as unworthy of submission to the Senate, an act by Monroe's mentor that stung him deeply. Whether a better diplomat might have succeeded, of course, is speculation. By the time Monroe had become Madison's Secretary of State in 1811, he had as much experience as any living American with diplomatic issues, and much experience at failing at such undertakings. It is ironic, then, that Monroe is best remembered for a foreign policy success, the Monroe Doctrine. Lacking the fiery oratorical skills of his fellow Virginian Patrick Henry, the unceasing questioning mind of Jefferson, or the wit and intellect of Franklin, Monroe nonetheless possessed important qualities. He had a reputation for the highest integrity. Jefferson once said that if Monroe's soul was turned inside out, there would not be a spot on it. And at the same time, the man refused to bear a grudge. It was this genial personality and willingness to work with others that inspired him to take a goodwill tour of the Northeast in 1816, initiating the era of good feelings. An absentee owner of a sizable plantation and several slaves, Monroe was traditional in a number of ways. Old-fashioned in his dress, he was the last president to wear his hair in a queue, Monroe in many ways was a throwback to the pre-revolutionary period. Above all, he valued productivity and practicality, which accounted for his policies and his toleration, even embrace, of those who held sharply different views but with whom he thought compromise possible. Unlike either Ronald Reagan or Dwight Eisenhower, two 20th-century advocates of limited or small government, Monroe favored a weak executive, seeing the power as emanating from the people through the legislature. Monroe's past inadequacies at diplomacy notwithstanding, he quickly secured an arrangement with Great Britain, limiting warships on the Great Lakes. This he followed by an equally rapid settlement of the U.S.-Canadian boundary dispute. Then came Andrew Jackson's campaigns against Indian incursions in Florida, which led to the Adams-Onis Treaty in 1819, all of which gave Monroe the international capital to issue the famous doctrine that bore his name. It also helped that Monroe's own sense of security led him to name some of the most powerful and politically contentious men in the nation to his cabinet. John C. Calhoun of South Carolina as Secretary of War, his rival William H. Crawford as Secretary of the Treasury, and John Quincy Adams as Secretary of State. Only a man unintimidated by powerful personalities would tolerate such characters, let alone enlist them. Ultimately, they jointly failed to live up to their potential, although individually Adams and Calhoun achieved reputations apart from the Monroe administration. Inside the cabinet, they bickered, eventually turning the atmosphere poisonous. Monroe acceded to a legislative program of internal improvements, a name given to federally funded harbor and river clearing efforts, road building, and otherwise upgrading infrastructure, to use the 21st century buzzword. Although he disapproved of government activism, he thought it proper to facilitate a climate of cooperation that funded construction of coastal forts, which fell perfectly within the constitutional mandates of national defense. In other areas, however, Monroe's strict constructionist side would not approve, without a constitutional amendment, appropriations for internal improvements that did not relate directly to national defense, maintaining that the Constitution had not given the government the authority to spend money for such programs. In the short term, minor government-funded construction programs paled beside the phenomenal economic explosion about to envelop the country. Despite the lingering economic dislocations of the War of 1812, already one could sense a restless, growing entrepreneurial nation replete with its share of vigor, vice, and virtue. This stirring occurred largely outside of Monroe's influence, although he certainly kept the government out of the way of growth. During the Madison-Monroe years, the United States gained ground on the British in key industries, so much so that by 1840, the Industrial Revolution that had started in England had not only reached American shores, but had accelerated so fast that Yankee shippers, iron merchants, publishers, and textile manufacturers either equaled or exceeded their John Bull competitors in nearly all categories. The Restless Spirit. From the outset, America had been a nation of entrepreneurs, a country populated by restless souls. No sooner had settlers arrived along the port cities than they spread inland, and after they had constructed the first inland forts, trappers and explorers pressed farther into the forests and mountains. The restless spirit and the dynamic entrepreneurship fed off each other, the former producing a constant itch to improve and invent, the latter demanding better ways of meeting people's needs, of organizing better systems of distribution and supply, and of adding to the yearning for still more and improved products. In a society where most people still worked the land, this incessant activity worked itself out in the relationship with the land: cutting, clearing, building, irrigating, herding, hunting, lighting and fighting fires, and populating. Unlike Europeans, however, Americans benefited from a constantly expanding supply of property they could possess and occupy. Unlike Europeans, Americans often never saw themselves as permanently fixed to a location. Alexis de Tocqueville, the observant French visitor, remarked, "An American will build a house in which to pass his old age and sell it before the roof is on. He will plant a garden and rent it just as the trees are coming into bearing. He will clear a field and leave others to reap the harvest. He will take up a profession and leave it, settle in one place and soon go off elsewhere with his changing desires. If his private business allows him a moment's relaxation, he will plunge at once into the whirlpool of politics." To some degree, money, or the lack of it, dictated constant churning. The same desire to experience material abundance drove men and women to perpetually invent and design, innovate and imagine. The motivations for moving, though, were as diverse as the country itself. For every Daniel Boone or Davy Crockett who constantly relocated out of land fever, there was a Gale Borden, a New York farm boy who wound up in Galveston, Texas, where he invented the terrapin wagon, a completely amphibious vehicle, before returning to New York to invent his famous condensed milk process. In the same vein, Vermonter John Deere, who moved his farm implement business steadily westward, developing the finest farm implements in the world, epitomized the restless frontier spirit observed by Tocqueville. This restless generation produced a group of entrepreneurs unparalleled in American history, including Andrew Carnegie, born 1835, J.P. Morgan, 1837, John D. Rockefeller, 1839, and Levi Strauss, 1829. Most came from lower to middle class backgrounds. Carnegie arrived in America virtually penniless, and Strauss worked his way up with a small mercantile store. They typified what a Cincinnati newspaper stated of this generation: there is not one who does not desire, even confidently expect, to become rich. Yet the lure of the land had its own dark side, turning otherwise honorable men into scallywags and forgers. Jim Bowie, who would die at the Alamo with Davy Crockett in 1836, surpassed everyone with his ingenuity in developing fraudulent land grants. One writer noted that whereas Bowie was hardly alone in forging grants, he worked on an almost industrial scale compared to others. Through a labyrinth of forged documents, Bowie managed to make himself one of the largest landowners in Louisiana, garnering a total holding of 45,700 acres. An official smelled a rat, but Bowie managed to extract all the suspicious documents before they landed him in jail. Land attracted small farmers to Indiana, then Illinois, then on to Minnesota and Wisconsin. Assuming that the minimal amount of land for self-sufficiency was 40 to 50 acres, it took only a few generations before a father would not bequeath to his son enough land to make a living, forcing countless American young men and their families westward. Southern legal traditions with vestigial primogeniture, or the custom of bequeathing the entire estate to the eldest son, resulted in fewer landowners and a smaller population, but much larger estates. Men like Bowie thus dealt not only in land, but also in slaves needed to run the plantations. Whether it was the Yazoo in Mississippi or the forested sections of Michigan, land hunger drew Americans steadily westward. Abundant land and scarce labor meant that even in agriculture, farmer businessmen substituted new technology for labor with every opportunity. Handmade hoes, shovels, rakes, and the like soon gave way to the James Woods metal plow, whose interchangeable parts made for easy repair. This and other designs were mass-produced by entrepreneurs like Charles Lane of Chicago, so that by the 1830s, metal plows were commonplace. Pittsburgh had two factories making 34,000 metal plows a year even in the 1830s, and by 1845, Massachusetts had 73 plow manufacturing firms turning out more than 60,000 farm implements a year. No more important, but certainly more celebrated, the famous McCormick Reaper, perfected by Cyrus McCormick, opened up the vast prairies to agribusiness. McCormick began on the East Coast, but relocated to Chicago to be closer to the land boom. After fashioning his first Reaper in 1834, he pumped up production until his factory churned out 4,000 Reapers annually. In an 1855 exposition in Paris, McCormick stunned Europeans by harvesting an acre of oats in 21 minutes, or one-third of the time taken by continental machines. If land provided the allure for most of those who moved to the Mississippi and beyond, a growing but important substrata of mechanics, artisans, inventors, salesmen, and merchants soon followed, adapting their businesses to the new frontier demands. No one captured the restless, inventive spirit better than Eli Whitney. After working on his father's farm in Connecticut, Whitney enrolled in and graduated from Yale. There he met Phineas Miller, who managed some South Carolina properties for Catherine Green, and Miller invited the young Whitney to take a position as a tutor to the Green children on a plantation. His cotton gin, in retrospect a remarkably simple device, shook the world, causing an explosion in textile production. In 1810, 119 pounds of cotton per day could be cleaned, and by 1860, that number had risen to 759 per day. Mrs. Green soon came to say of Whitney, "He can make anything." Indeed, he could. Whitney soon tried his hand at musket production, using a largely unskilled workforce. What emerged was the American system of manufacturing, which served as the basis for a powerful expansion in production. Advances in mass production, steam power, and management techniques coalesced in the textile mills founded in New England by Samuel Slater, a British emigrant. Slater built a small mill in Rhode Island with the support of Moses Brown, a Providence candle manufacturer, first using water wheels, then replacing water with steam power. Within 20 years, Slater and his close circle of associates had 9,500 spindles and controlled nearly half of all American spinning mills. Brown even wrote to his children that the mill founders had cotton mill fever. Francis Cabot Lowell exceeded even Slater's achievements in textile production, employing young girls who lived on site. Lowell further advanced the organizational gains made by Whitney and Slater. Gains in manufacturing resulted in part from widespread application of steam power. John Fitch, with clockmaker partner Henry Voigt, invented the steamboat in 1786 and demonstrated it to members of the Constitutional Convention the following year. But the unfortunate Fitch acquired a charter to run steam service on the Delaware River, which was easy to sail and had broad roads running up the sides, and after losing his investors' money, committed suicide. As his biographer Kirkpatrick Sale observed, Fitch picked the wrong river. In Fitch's wake, so to speak, came the more commercially savvy Robert Fulton, whose Clermont demonstrated profitable steam propulsion on water in 1807. Allied with Robert Livingston, Fulton got a charter to operate on the Hudson, which made better financial sense, and the technology had improved since Fitch's death as well. The steamboat revolutionized transportation. Within a decade, Cornelius Vanderbilt began using steam technology to cut costs in the New York-New Jersey ferry traffic, and steam power started to find its way to inland waterways. Entrepreneurs had already started to shift the focus of water travel in the interior from natural rivers to man-made canals. The period from 1817 to 1844 has been referred to as the Canal Era, in which some 4,000 miles of canals were constructed at a cost of $200 million. States collaborated with private interests in many of these projects, usually by guaranteeing state bond issues in case of default. But some of the earliest and best were built by private businesses, such as the Middlesex Canal in Massachusetts and the Santee and Cooper Canal in South Carolina. The most famous, the Erie Canal, linked the Hudson River and Lake Erie and opened up the upstate New York markets to the coast. Unlike some of the other early privately financed canals, the Erie was built at state expense over an 8-year period, and its completion was so anticipated that the state collected an advance of $1 million in tolls before the canal was even opened. It was a massive engineering feat. The canal was 40 feet wide, 4 feet deep, and 363 miles long, all bordered by towpaths to allow draft animals to pull barges and flatboats. 86 locks were used to raise and lower boats 565 feet. When the Erie opened in 1825, it earned 8% on its $9 million from the 3,000 boats traversing the canal. After the Board of Commissioners approved enlarging the canal in 1850, it reached its peak tonnage in 1880. Steam power soon replaced animal power on all the nation's waterways. Well before steam power was common, however, canals had driven down the costs of shipping from 20 cents per ton mile to a tenth of that amount, and even a noted financial failure like the Ohio Canal yielded a respectable 10% social rate of return. Steam vessels on the Great Lakes, where ships occasionally exceeded 1,000 tons, and in the case of the City of Buffalo, displaced a whopping 2,200 tons, also played an important role. By mid-century, the tonnage on the Mississippi River and on the Great Lakes exceeded that of all shipping from New York City by over 200%. The Canal Era provided the first model of state government support of large-scale enterprise through bond guarantees, often with disastrous results. In the Panic of 1837, many states were pushed to the brink of bankruptcy by their canal bond obligations. Steam also reduced shipping costs for oceanic travel, where, again, Cornelius Vanderbilt emerged as a key player. Facing a competitor who received sizable federal mail subsidies, Vanderbilt nevertheless drove down his own transatlantic costs to the point where he consistently outperformed his government-supported opponent. Having won on the Hudson, then on the Atlantic, Vanderbilt next struck on the Pacific coast, breaking into the subsidized packet steamer trade. Vanderbilt's competition received $500,000 in federal subsidies and charged a staggering $600 per passenger ticket for a New York to California trip via Panama, where the passengers had to disembark and travel overland to board another vessel. After constructing his own route through Nicaragua rather than Panama, Vanderbilt chopped passenger prices to $400 and offered to carry the mail free. Within a year, thanks to the presence of Vanderbilt, fares dropped to $150, then $100. As occurred in the Hudson competition, the Commodore's competitors finally bought his routes, but even then they found they could never return to the high ticket prices they had charged before he drove costs down. When Vanderbilt left the packet steamer business, a ticket cost just half what could be fleeced from passengers in the pre-Vanderbilt era. Steam technology also provided the basis for another booming American industry when Philip Thomas led a group of Baltimore businessmen to found the Baltimore and Ohio B&O Railroad in 1828. 2 years later, the South Carolina Canal and Railroad Company began a steam locomotive train service westward from Charleston, with its locomotive Best Friend of Charleston being the first constructed for sale in the United States. The king of American locomotive building was Matthias Baldwin, who made his first locomotive in 1832 and founded the Baldwin Engine and Locomotive Works. His firm turned out more than 1,500 locomotives during his lifetime, including many for export. Within a few years, contemporaries were referring to railroad building as a fever, a frenzy, and a mania. There were enormous positive social consequences of better transportation. By linking Orange County, New York, the leading dairy county, to New York City, the railroad contributed to the reduction of milk-borne diseases like cholera by supplying fresh milk. By 1840, most states had railroads, although the Atlantic seaboard states had more than 60% of total rail mileage. Like the canals, many railroads received state backing. Some were constructed by individual entrepreneurs. But the high capital demands of the railroads, combined with the public's desire to link up every burg by rail, led to states taking a growing role in the financing of American railroads. Railroads' size and scope of operations required vast amounts of capital compared to textile mills or ironworks. This dynamic forced them to adopt a new structure in which the multiple stockholder owners selected a professional manager to run the firm. By the 1840s, banks and railroads were inexorably linked, not only through the generation of capital, but also through the new layer of professional managers, many of them put in place by the banks that owned the majority stock positions. As transportation improved, communications networks also proliferated. Banks could evaluate the quality of private banknote issues through Dilliston's Banknote Reporter, which was widely circulated. The Cincinnati-based Bradstreet Company provided similar evaluation of businesses themselves. Investor knowledge benefited from the expansion of the U.S. Post Office, which had over 18,000 branches by 1850, one for every 1,300 people. Congress had a direct stake in the Post Office in that congressional apportionment was based on population, and since constituents clamored for new routes, there was a built-in bias in favor of expanding the postal network. Most routes did not even bear more than 1% of their cost, but that was irrelevant given the political gains they represented. In addition to their value in apportionment, the postal branches offered legislators a free election tool. Congressmen shipped speeches and other election materials to constituents free, thanks to the franking privileges. Partisan concerns also linked post office branches and the party-controlled newspapers by reducing the cost of distribution through the mails. From 1800 to 1840, the number of newspapers transmitted through the mails rose from 2 million to almost 140 million at far cheaper rates than other printed matter. Postal historian Richard John estimated that if the newspapers had paid the same rate as other mails, the transmission costs would have been 700 times higher. The new party system by 1840 had thus compromised the independence of the mails and a large part of the print media, with no small consequences. Among other defects, the subsidies created incentives to read newspapers rather than books. This democratization of the news produced a population of people who thought they knew a great deal about current events, but who lacked the theoretical grounding in history, philosophy, or politics to properly ground their opinions. As the number of U.S. post office branches increased, the post office itself came to wield considerable clout, and the position of postmaster became a political plum. The Postmaster General alone controlled more than 8,700 jobs, more than three-fourths of the federal civilian workforce, larger even than the Army. Patronage explained the ability of companies receiving federal subsidies to repel challenges from the private sector, allowing the subsidized postal companies to defeat several private expresses in the 1830s. The remarkable thing about the competition to the subsidized mails was not that it lasted so long and did not resurface until Fred Smith founded Federal Express in 1971, but that it even appeared in the first place. This is particularly noteworthy given that the federal government aggressively pursued criminal action against competitors to protect the government's postal monopoly in the delivery of non-urgent letters. Setting the table for growth. At the end of the War of 1812, America emerged in a strong military and diplomatic position. The end of the Franco-British struggle not only quickened an alliance between the two European powerhouses, but also inevitably drew the United States into their orbit, and a century later, them into ours. American involvement in two world wars fought primarily in Europe and a third Cold War was based on the premise that the three nations shared fundamental assumptions about human rights and civic responsibilities that tied them together more closely than any other sets of allies in the world. Getting to that point, however, would not have been possible without consistently solid diplomacy and sensible restraint at critical times, as in the case of Florida, which remained an important pocket of foreign occupation in the map of the United States east of the Mississippi. In 1818, Spain held on to Florida by a slender thread, for the once mighty Spanish Empire was in complete disarray. Spain's economic woes and corrupt imperial bureaucracy encouraged revolutionaries in Argentina, Colombia, and Mexico to follow the American example and overthrow their European masters. Within 5 years, Spain lost nearly half of its holdings in the Western Hemisphere. From the point of view of the United States, Florida was ripe for the plucking. President Monroe and his Secretary of State, John Quincy Adams, understandably wanted to avoid overtly seizing Florida from Spain, a nation with which they were at peace. Adams opened negotiations with the Spanish minister, Luis Dionis. Before they could arrive at a settlement, General Andrew Jackson seized Florida for the United States. But Jackson followed a route to Pensacola that is more complex and troublesome for historians to trace today than it was for Jackson and his men to march through it in 1818. Jackson's capture of Florida began when Monroe sent him south to attack Seminole Indians, allies of the reviled Creeks he had defeated at Horseshoe Bend in 1814. Some Seminole used northern Florida's panhandle region as a base to raid American planters and harbor escaped slaves. Alabamians and Georgians demanded government action. On December 26, 1817, the Secretary of War, John C. Calhoun, ordered Jackson to adopt the necessary measures to neutralize the Seminoles, but did not specify whether he was to cross the international boundary in his pursuit. In a letter to Monroe, Jackson wrote that he would gladly defeat the Seminoles and capture Spanish Florida if it was signified to me through any channel that the possession of the Floridas would be desirable to the United States. Jackson later claimed he received the go-ahead, a point the administration staunchly denied. The general went so far as to promise that he would insure you Cuba in a few days if Monroe would supply him with a frigate, an offer the president wisely refused. Later, when questioned about his unwillingness to rein in the expansionist Jackson, Monroe pleaded ill health. Whoever was telling the truth, it mattered little to the Indians and Spaniards, who soon felt the wrath of the hero of New Orleans. Between April 1st and May 28th, Andrew Jackson's military accomplishments were nothing short of spectacular. Indeed, some deemed them outrageous. He invaded Florida and defeated the Seminole raiders, capturing their chiefs along with two English citizens, Alexander Arbuthnot and Robert Ambrister, who had the great misfortune of being with the Indians at the time. Convinced the Englishmen were responsible for fomenting Indian attacks, Jackson court-martialed and hanged both men. By mid-May, he had moved on to Fort Pensacola, which surrendered to him on May 28, 1818, making Florida part of the United States by right of conquest, despite the illegality of Jackson's invasion, all carried out without exposure to journalists. Although Monroe and Adams later disclaimed Jackson's actions, they did not punish him, nor did they return the huge prize of his warfare, nor did Congress censure him for usurping its constitutional war power. Jackson was able to wildly supersede his authority, largely because of the absence of an omnipresent media, but the United States gained substantially from the general's actions. Illegal as Jackson's exploits were, the fact was that Spain could not patrol its own borders. The Seminole posed a clear and present danger, and the campaign was not unlike that launched by General John Pershing in 1916 with the approval of Woodrow Wilson and Congress to invade Mexico for the purpose of capturing the bandit Pancho Villa. Jackson set the stage for Adams to formalize the victory in a momentous diplomatic agreement. The Adams-Onis Treaty of 1819 settled the Florida question and also addressed three other matters crucial to America's westward advance across the continent. First, the United States paid Spain $5 million and gained all of Florida, which was formally conveyed in July 1821. In addition, Adams agreed that Spanish Texas was not part of the Louisiana Purchase, as some American expansionists had erroneously claimed. Negotiators had formalized the hazy 1803 Louisiana Purchase boundary line all the way to the Canadian border. Finally, Spain relinquished all claims to the Pacific Northwest, leaving the Indians, Russians, and British with the United States as the remaining claimants. From Santa Fe to the Montana Country. In 1820, Monroe dispatched an army expedition to map and explore the Adams-Onis Treaty line. Major Stephen H. Long keelboated up the Missouri and Platte Rivers in search of, but never finding, the mouth of the Red River and a pass through the Rocky Mountains. Labeling the central Great Plains a Great American Desert, Long helped to perpetuate a fear of crossing, much less settling what is now the American heartland. He also helped to foster a belief that this remote and bleak land was so worthless that it was suitable only for a permanent Indian frontier, a home for relocated Eastern Indian tribes. Concurrent with Long's expedition, however, a trade route opened that would ultimately encourage Americanization of the Great Plains. Following the Mexican Revolution of 1820, the Santa Fe Trail opened, bringing American traders to the once forbidden lands of New Mexico. Santa Fe, in the mountains of northernmost Mexico, was closer to St. Louis than it was to Mexico City, a fact that Missouri merchants were quick to act upon. Santa Fe traders brought steamboat cargoes of goods from St. Louis up the Missouri to Independence, founded officially in 1827. There they outfitted huge 2-ton Conestoga wagons, hitched to teams of 10 to 12 oxen, gathered supplies, and listened to the latest reports from other travelers. They headed out with the green grass of May and, lacking federal troop escorts, traveled together in wagon trains to fend off Kiowa and Comanche Indians. The teamsters carried American cloth, cutlery, and hardware, and returned with much-coveted Mexican silver, fur, and mules. The Santa Fe trade lasted until 1844, the eve of the Mexican-American War, providing teamsters practice that perfected Plains wagoneering techniques, and their constant presence in the West chipped away at the Great American Desert myth. Moreover, they established the Missouri River towns that would soon serve the Oregon Trail immigrant wagon trains. At the same time, Rocky Mountain fur traders, the Mountain Men, headed up the Missouri to Montana, Wyoming, and Colorado country. British and American fur companies, such as the Northwest, American, and Hudson's Bay companies, had operated posts on the Pacific Northwest coast since the 1790s. But in the 1820s, Americans sought the rich beaver trade of the inland mountains. St. Louis, at the mouth of the Missouri, served again as a major entrepot for early entrepreneurs like Manuel Lisa and William H. Ashley. Ashley's Rocky Mountain Fur Company sent an exploratory company of adventurers up the Missouri to the mouth of the Yellowstone River in 1822-23, founding Fort William Henry near today's Montana-North Dakota boundary. This expedition included Big Mike Fink, Jedediah Smith, and other independent trappers who would form the cadre of famous mountain men during the 1820s and 1830s. But by the 1840s, the individual trappers were gone, victims of corporate buyouts and their own failure to conserve natural resources. They had, for example, overhunted the once plentiful beaver of the northern and southern Rockies. Significantly, mountain men explored and mapped the Rockies and their western slopes, paving the way for Oregon Trail migrants and California 49ers to follow. Beyond the Monroe Doctrine. Expansion into the Great American Desert exposed an empire in disarray, Spain, and revealed a power vacuum that existed throughout North and South America. The weak new Mexican and Latin American republics provided an inviting target for European colonialism. It was entirely possible that a new European power, Russia, Prussia, France, or Britain, would rush in and claim the old Spanish colonies for themselves. America naturally wanted no new European colony started in its path west. In 1822, France received tacit permission from other European powers to restore a monarchy in Spain, where Republican forces had created a constitutional government. To say the least, these developments were hardly in keeping with American democratic ideals. Monroe certainly could do little and say even less, given the reality of the situation. However, a somewhat different twist to the Europeans' suppression of republican government occurred in the wake of the French invasion of Spain. Both Monroe and John C. Calhoun, the Secretary of War, expressed concerns that France might seek to extend its power to Spain's former colonies in the New World, using debts owed by the Latin American republics as an excuse to either invade or overthrow South American democracies. Britain would not tolerate such intrusions, if for no other reason than traditional balance of power politics. England could not allow even friendly former enemies to establish geostrategic enclaves in the New World. To circumvent European attempts to recolonize parts of the Western Hemisphere, British Foreign Minister George Canning inquired if the United States would like to pursue a joint course of resistance to any European involvement in Latin America. Certainly, an arrangement of this type was in America's interests. Britain wanted a free trade zone for British ships in the Western Hemisphere, as did the United States. But Adams, who planned to run for president in 1824, knew better than to identify himself as an ally of England, reviving the old charges of Adams's Anglophilia. Instead, he urged Monroe to issue an independent declaration of foreign policy. The resulting Monroe Doctrine, presented as a part of the message to Congress in 1823, formed the basis of American isolationist foreign policy for nearly a century, and it forms the basis for America's relationship with Latin America to this day. Basically, the doctrine instructed Europe to stay out of political and military affairs in the Western Hemisphere, and in return, the United States would stay out of European political and military affairs. In addition, Monroe promised not to interfere in the existing European colonies in South America. Monroe's audacity outraged the Europeans. Baron de Teuil, the Russian minister to the United States, wrote that the doctrine enunciates views and pretensions so exaggerated and establishes principles so contrary to the rights of the European powers that it merits only the most profound contempt. Prince Metternich, the Chancellor of Austria, snorted that the United States had cast blame and scorn on the institutions of Europe, while L'Etoile in Paris asked, "By what right, then, would the two Americas today be under immediate sway of the United States?" Monroe, L'Etoile pointed out, is not a sovereign. Not all Europeans reacted negatively. "Today, for the first time," the Paris-based Constitutionnel wrote on January 2, 1824, "the new continent says to the old, 'I am no longer land for occupation. Here men are masters of the soil which they occupy, and the equals of the people from whom they came. The new continent is right." While no one referred to the statement as the Monroe Doctrine until 1852, it quickly achieved notoriety. In pragmatic terms, however, it depended almost entirely on the Royal Navy. Although the Monroe Doctrine supported the newly independent Latin American republics in Argentina, Colombia, and Mexico against Europeans, many Americans hoped to do some colonizing of their own. Indeed, it is no coincidence that the Monroe Doctrine paralleled the Adams-Onis Treaty, Long's Expedition, the opening of the Santa Fe Trail, and the Rocky Mountain fur trade. America had its eyes set west, on the weak Mexican Republic and its northernmost provinces, Texas, New Mexico, and California. Nevertheless, when James Monroe left office in 1825, he handed to his successor a nation with no foreign wars or entanglements, an economy booming with enterprise, and a political system ostensibly purged of partisan politics, at least for a brief time. What Monroe ignored completely was the lengthening shadow of slavery that continued to stretch its hand across the Republic, and which, under Monroe's administration, was revived as a contentious